America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day because the United States has actually won a victory, says Max Boot, who is an expert and a historian, distinguished historian, about some of the minor wars that we have fought throughout our history, wars that many people forget about. Oh, like the war in the Philippines? Well, right now we're in a shadow war with Iran. And how did we just win an unheralded victory? We will get to that. We will also be speaking to Gil Troy, who is a distinguished scholar in North American history at McGill University in Montreal, but he's been living in Jerusalem for years. He is an award-winning presidential historian, and he'll be talking with us about the secret of Israeli happiness. And part of the happiness that I think needs to be examined for a moment is some of the misunderstanding of what it is that Israel announced yesterday that has surprised many people. The Israeli military said yesterday that it had already withdrawn a full division of ground troops from southern Gaza as international mediators gathered with hopes of brokering a temporary ceasefire 6 months into a war that has now become the longest involving Israel since the 1980s. Israel has significantly reduced the number of troops it has on the ground in Gaza over the past several months. Only a fraction of the soldiers that it deployed in the territory earlier in the war against Hamas remain. Now, this is incredibly good news. And of course, like most of the time when there's good news, forget about it. You hear nothing. But if it's terrible news, you hear all about it. Why is this good news? Because, first of all, it signifies that Israel has been winning the war. They have not announced that they are abandoning their announced plans to go after the last four battalions of Hamas, who are right now hiding in tunnels under Rafah. It's that the fact is that because of the progress they have made against the terrorist killers of Hamas, they don't need all the troops to be on the border. They don't need all the troops to be on the inside Gaza. They need to try to send people home and back to their jobs. When you're talking about a citizen army, when you're talking about people being called up from their work, look, I know this because my nephews were called up. My brother's children. And some of the stories that you hear about some of the sacrifices that people have made already in this war, it's incredibly encouraging that they're able to send more people home. And no one knows the exact numbers, but of the 360,000 people who were originally called up, there are estimates that as many as half of them have been able to go home and return to work and return to keeping the Israeli economy healthy and functioning. And the New York Times reports, now the last group of Israeli soldiers in the southern city of Khan Yunus has left Gaza in order to, quote, recuperate and prepare for future operations, the army said. The withdrawal of the soldiers, members of the 98th Division, means that no Israeli troops are actively maneuvering in southern Gaza, the Israeli news media reported. But Israeli officials made clear that the army would stay in other parts of Gaza to preserve its freedom of action and its ability to conduct precise intelligence-based operations. And those operations will continue at the very least until all of the hostages are liberated. There is the mother of one of the hostages. Her name is Orna Nutra. She went onto CNN with Jake Tapper. And she has been part of this organized movement of hostage families. And yes, some of those hostage families are right here in the United States because there are at least five American hostages still being held. And Orna Nutra spoke about what the future means in terms of the more than 130 hostages who remain. Clip two.
Bringing the hostages back should be the top priority. It should be a world top priority. Everyone looking for de-escalation in the region should be opening the sentence saying, you know, release the hostages. You know, any sentence of any demand of ceasefire without release of hostages is a death sentence to them. As far as what's going on in Israel, you know, there's a broad range. Everyone feels that more needs to be done. Everyone is demanding more from the government. You know, people and different families have different perspectives on how to achieve that. And that's what we're seeing.
And some part of that perspective is the perspective of families that want to see their young men, sometimes middle-aged men, because you do your reserve service until you're in your 40s in Israel, to see people coming home and getting back to work. John Kirby on Fox News on Friday talked about why, no, this may be the beginnings of a ceasefire, but it's not going to be the end of the war. Listen, this is clip five.
Number one, you can't look at all the things that we've been doing for Israel since the 7th of October and suggest that we are somehow walking away from their ability to defend themselves. And frankly, in the call yesterday, the president made it very clear to Prime Minister Netanyahu that we know they have a right and responsibility to go after that threat, and we're going to continue to help them do that. It's how they do it that matters. Because one thing that does strengthen Hamas's hand, Martha, is for them to capitalize on the imagery of civilian infrastructure and capitalize on the imagery that's out there of innocent Palestinians being killed and wounded as a result of this conflict. So we want to get that ceasefire in place, temporary, 6 weeks or so, to get those hostages out, get more humanitarian assistance in.
And part of that means that the Democrats should stop playing into Hamas's hands. There is a powerful and very relevant editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and it points out that the late great Middle East scholar Bernard Lewis, taught for many years at Princeton, liked to quip that while it is dangerous to be America's enemy, it can be fatal to be his friend. That sad wisdom comes to mind as leading Democrats increase their pressure on Israel to end the war against Hamas before the terror group is defeated. The latest sunshine ally is Nancy Pelosi. The former House Speaker joined a letter signed by 40 House Democrats, yes, including Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, of 40 House Democrats urging President Biden to stop transferring weapons to Israel. In the wake of the mistaken bombing on a relief convoy, the members write, "We strongly urge you to reconsider your recent decision to authorize a transfer of a new arms package to Israel and to withhold this and any future offensive arms transfers until a full investigation into the airstrike is completed." This is outrageous. And fortunately, you're hearing a different message from the White House. I will hear a very different message and perspective from Gil Troy coming up on the Michael Medved Show.
Your daily dose of debate.
Calm down for a minute. Do you understand how irrational you're sounding?
Because I'm not sounding irrational.
You're not. Uh-huh.
No.
This is the Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
Actor Jonathan Majors will not be
award-winning American presidential historian and a leading Zionist activist. His most recent book is called The Zionist Ideas, plural, Visions for the Jewish Homeland, Then, Now, and Tomorrow. Gil is the author of an absolutely wonderful piece. I hope every American reads it. It's called Why Israelis Are So Happy, and it discusses a phenomenon that we've spent time on this show, considerable time actually, which is in the World Happiness Index. Israel was currently rated number 5, number 1 among all non-Scandinavian countries, and number 2, even ahead of the Scandinavian countries, in terms of the happiness of people under 30. Gil, let me start with that because it relates to your column. Why do you think it is that young people in the United States are ranked 62nd for happiness? And young people for Israel are ranked 2nd. Well, the only country with happier young people than Israel is Lithuania. So
it's anomalous, right? Because all we read about in Israel is we read about war and suffering and disunity and threat. And America's all about living in the vast shopping mall called the United States of America. But what we're actually understanding is that happiness isn't about enjoyment. Purely. It's not about indulgence. It's about having a sense of purpose. It's about having a sense of community. And it's about having a sense of rootedness. And Israelis are experts in that. Israelis understand that they're not just living in 2024, but they're living as part of a 76-year-old miracle called the State of Israel and a 3,500-year-old story of the Jewish people. But more than that, and especially these last painful, painful months, young Israelis have understood that they have something to die for. And when you have something to die for, you have something to live for. And unfortunately, too many Americans are so busy just focusing on the I, the me, the my, the now, they don't have any sense of anything bigger than themselves, and it strips their souls, and it strips their lives of meaning, and it's heartbreaking to watch.
Well, I was watching the impact of an image that you conjure up in your column. Your son got married in the middle of this war. And I thought back to my nephew's wedding in 2007 in Jerusalem. And he was in the midst of his army service. And in very, very big wedding, lavish and joyous and everybody just feeling wonderful. And then he got up for a circle dance with the members of his unit. And they all had their M1s at over their shoulders. And they were dancing and singing Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live. That's kind of the image you're trying to conjure up about the whole society, isn't it?
Absolutely. I call that heavy metal dancing. Because as difficult as it is at my advanced age to be in the middle of a circle of all these young men dancing intensely and the joy. My son was married on November 26th, which in America we call Thanksgiving Sunday, but in Israel we just call Sunday. And we had 42 maybes because we didn't know if people were going to come. And people from the north and from the south came, and they indeed had their submachine guns on their shoulders. And the intensity of the joy was saying that we are a cult of life, not a cult of death, that we are affirming life, and that if you give us an excuse to celebrate the good in life, the continuity in life, the connectivity in life, we're going to do it, and that's why we're going to win, because we're not about negating others. We're not about knocking others down. We're about building ourselves up. And my son actually spoke those words that I quoted after he finished 161 days in reserves. And I said to him, you know, there's a Jewish tradition of having Sheva Brachot of seven blessings for the 7 days after the wedding. And I said, when you get out, we're going to have an eighth because you and your wife haven't had a chance to start off as equals, and was basically pressing a reset button. And every day we in Israel are forced to be pressing that reset button. But there was so much joy at that moment, too, because we're looking forward and we're not just looking backward. We're not just mourning, and we certainly are mourning, but we're also saying that we have a plan. We have a vision, and we have one another, and we have our tradition, and those are priceless.
Well, there's something else that's priceless. I just mentioned my nephew, who whose wedding I was so privileged to attend. He and his wife have now been blessed with 8 children.
No, amen.
Which is, again, something else people don't know about Israel. Israel has the highest birth rate of any country in the OECD.
And that was the 1200. That was a 1200 version, 1200 word version of the article.
well, there it is. But what does that larger, higher birth rate signify?
It signifies an affirmation of life. And by the way, people sometimes say, "Oh, well, Israel has a very high birth rate because of the ultra Orthodox and because of the Israeli Arabs." The truth is that the number of Israeli Arab births is slightly going down as they're becoming more middle class. And the typical Israeli family, which is more mainstream and more secular, but secular is the wrong word because these are secular people who celebrate the Sabbath. Even if they're not the most rigorous, they're certainly going to gather around a Friday night meal. They're going to have all the holidays. They believe in God. They sit for 7 days of mourning, not with a two-day discount you're often getting in the United States of America. They're deeply rooted in tradition, even though they call themselves secular. And these families are also 2, 3, 4 kids. We have 4 children, and when we were living in Montreal, every time we'd come to the airport, they'd look at us like we were nut jobs. And when we'd come to Israel with our 4 children, they'd go, "Okay, so when are you starting a family?" And the love of kids, the love of the future. And each child is really, as you know, a leap of faith and a leap into the future. And so the high birth rate is a reflection of an affirmation of life, no matter what's going on, even during these difficult times. And I have to say that during these last couple of months, I've been to more funerals than I would care to imagine. I've watched the phenomenon of grandchildren, of grandparents burying their grandchildren. But I've also been to so many weddings and so many birth celebrations, because Israelis refuse to be defeated. And they know that the best way to win is not just by winning the war, but by living a full life, because Hamas and the Palestinian terrorists are trying to rob them of joy. And so every time we smile, every time we dance, every time your nephew has yet another child, we are saying we're going to win because we are a people of life, not of death. And that's what Americans need to learn. Americans used to be that kind of people, and there still is a strong feeling of that in the society, but not enough. And the more sophisticated, the more progressive, the more elite you are in American society, you think you have to evolve away from family and community, and that's dangerous.
Gil Troy, his books are posted, and his most recent column in the Wall Street Journal, at michaelmedved.com. And Yishkoyach to you. I so much appreciate your coming on the show and telling people a message they need to hear. We will have a surprise message. Well, it's actually from Bill Clinton, but it was just posted today. And it's about Israel and Hamas. We'll talk about it coming up.
Entertain your brain.
It's awesome.
Every day on The Michael Medved Show.
And I mentioned before a message from Bill Clinton. It's not a recent message. It's a message that he delivered in 2016. And you'll remember, of course, he left the presidency in the year 2001. So it's after he was president. And what he said is, "I killed myself to give the Palestinians a state." He doesn't mean literally, it's a figure of speech. "I killed myself. I worked hard," how's that sounds better, "to give the Palestinians a state. I had a deal they turned down that would have given them all of Gaza and between 96% and 97% of the West Bank, compensating land in Israel, you name it. Here is the audio of Bill Clinton delivering these sentiments, which are, couldn't be more relevant to what is happening today. Listen to the former president.
Depends on whether you care what happens to the Palestinians as opposed to the Hamas government and the people with guided missiles. Yes, they were. Yes, they were. Now, wait a minute. Yes, they were. And Hamas is really smart. When they decide to rocket Israel, they insinuate themselves in the hospitals, in the schools, in the highly populous areas, and they are smart. So they try. So they, wait. So they try to put the Israelis in a position of either not defending themselves or killing innocents. They're good at it. They're smart. They've been doing this a long time. Look, I don't agree. I killed myself to give the Palestinians a state. I had a deal they turned down that would have given them all of Gaza, all of Gaza, between 96 and 97% of the West Bank, compensating land in Israel.
And that's basically true. The arrangement that he's talking about was when he went up to Camp David, and it was his bid to try to win a Nobel Peace Prize and really do some good in the world. And it was together with the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak at the time and Yasser Arafat. And for instance, one of the things that they had provided was that Jerusalem would be divided. There would be the part of Jerusalem in which they had the predominant Arab population. Jerusalem is 70% Jewish population. But there are parts of Jerusalem and East Jerusalem where there are more Arabs than Jews. So that would have been separated. And President Clinton apparently at one point said to Yasser Arafat, why haven't you accepted that? It's just more than any Israeli government has been willing to give you ever before. And he says, we don't want to accept this because we don't want to give up the land of our holy city, Jerusalem. He said, well, what about the part of the land where the temple, the Jewish temple stood, the first temple and the second temple, literally for more than 1,000 years? What about that land? He said, what temple? There was no temple. And again, for people who have toured Jerusalem, the steps of the temple are still extant. I mean, it is referred to by Greek historians from the time. And the idea that the Palestinian leader, the leader of Palestinian nationalism, Yasser Arafat, would actually believe this idiotic position of temple denial, which is one of the pillars of the current Palestinian worldview, that there never was a temple in Jerusalem, that the Jewish people have no actual connection with the land. And you see, it's part of what is so incredibly necessary before there's any meaningful step for peace with the Palestinians, any settlement, is basically to disabuse yourself of ideas that are ludicrous and wrong. Meanwhile, speaking of ideas that are humorous and that are ludicrous and wrong, not humorous at all, actually, there is the fantasy that somehow we are suffering from a bloodbath at the border. The border bloodbath, Biden's border bloodbath. Trump recently spoke with that three B's, Biden's border bloodbath. I guess it's four B's, really. In any event, Michael Steele on MSNBC spoke about that. This is clip 9.
Donald Trump is leaning into a dark and dystopian version of America, and his distortion of reality is reaching a new low when it comes to immigration. He's now embracing the word bloodbath to falsely blame migrants for crime waves that, guess what, just not happening. And he described President Biden's economic record as, quote, a migrant job fair. Also this week, Trump voiced support for a woman convicted of illegally entering the Capitol during the insurrection, calling her one of the, quote, J6 hostages.
Okay, the reason that you know that the a migrant bloodbath is not happening is because very consistently, if you look at towns on the border, communities on the border, like El Paso, which is literally on the border. You just cross the bridge to go over to Ciudad Juarez, which is Mexico. In El Paso, and in San Diego, in Phoenix, in other places that are heavy with migrants, the crime rate is lower than it is in other cities in the inland with less of an immigration presence or problem. This alleged correlation between immigration and crime is a fallacy without grounding. Meanwhile, speaking of a fallacy, there are so many fallacies involving Iran. On February 2nd, and yes, this is a long time ago, U.S. forces dropped more than 125 precision munitions on 85 targets in Iraq and Syria belonging to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, and its affiliated militia groups. The U.S. Air Force even deployed giant B-1 bombers that flew all the way from the continental U.S. According to U.S. Central Command, the facilities that were struck included command and control operation centers, intelligence centers, rockets, missiles, unmanned aerial vehicle storage, and logistics and munition supply chains, facilities of militia groups and their IRGC sponsors who facilitated attacks against U.S. and coalition forces. 5 days later, there was a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad that killed a senior commander of Kataib Hezbollah, one of the most dangerous Iranian-backed terror groups. This demonstrated not only how precise U.S. weapon systems are, but also how successful U.S. intelligence was in tracking the movements of senior Iranian operatives. The clear message was that other Iranian commanders would be next if they don't knock off their attacks against U.S. troops. And guess what? Iran did stop. That was in February. Things could change at any moment, but a senior U.S. defense official told me last week that there hasn't been an Iranian-directed attack against a U.S. military base in either Syria or Iraq since February 4th. By contrast, there were at least 170 such attacks between October 7th and February 4th. So what does it mean? We will get to that, but it's encouraging. We'll also talk about the squatters problem and how ludicrous and bizarre that has become. Coming up on The Medved Show.
This is going to be a little bit provocative.
The Michael Medved Show.
That attack that was ordered by President Biden on Iranian targets in Syria and Iraq, knocking out some of the militias that have been attacking and killing Americans. And Max Boot writes in his syndicated column from the Washington Post, "This is an important and unheralded, if likely transitory, victory in the long-running shadow war between the United States and Iran, which stretches all the way back to 1979. It's by far the longest pause in such attacks since the start of the Israel-Hamas war," a U.S. official told me. and believe it, and we believe it reflects a deliberate decision by Iran to rein in attacks by its forces in order to avoid escalation with the United States. This is important. He writes that there is no lasting solution to the Iranian problem as long as that country continues to have a fundamentalist regime hostile to the United States and its allies. And there is no way for Washington to overthrow the Iranian regime without risking becoming embroiled in another Iraq or Afghanistan-style quagmire. Instead, in many ways, Iran is becoming more dangerous. It is ramping up its nuclear program to near weapons-grade levels of enrichment, and it is supplying Russia with drones, artillery shells, and missiles for its war against Ukraine. But he points out it's high time for the United States and its coalition partners to undertake more sustained air campaigns against Houthi military installations and even Houthi leaders to persuade the militia group to finally end its attacks on shipping. Those strikes have led to an 80% decline in the volume of freight passing through the Red Sea since November. It's not a question of winning the shadow war with Iran. It's simply a matter of convincing Iran to decrease its attacks across the board, not just in Iraq and Syria. This is one of those international problems so difficult that it cannot be solved, at least not in the foreseeable future. It can only be managed, which is why I'm relieved to have a prudent and experienced president in the White House, surrounded by prudent and experienced advisors. Actually, the kind of up the middle, it seems to me, appreciation for some things that the Biden administration has been able to accomplish. And the question being, how do you continue that kind of energy and that kind of direction with all of the problems at hand? One of those problems has to do with this recent desire to authorize and even respect squatting. And squatting in Seattle got some national attention from Fox News. Clip 7A.
All right, it's gotten to be a huge trend. It's happened across the country, but particularly in Seattle, where squatters occupying homes are now getting tax breaks and help in doing so. It sounds a little bizarre. Dan Springer has more. Dan.
It's especially frustrating for the owner of this house as he believes that the laws and the courts are totally against him, but he also sees that taxpayers are ending up on the hook paying back rent, allowing this family of squatters to stay in his $2 million house. Sang Kim, along with his wife and son, moved into this pricey Bellevue, Washington home in August of 2022. At the time, he claimed an income of $400,000. He paid just 1 month's rent and hasn't paid since, but has bought two new cars. Neighbors have rallied around the homeowner, Jaskaran Singh, who immigrated from India and just became a U.S. citizen in December. Singh has won three eviction cases against Kim, but each time a taxpayer-funded nonprofit sends him a check for unpaid rent. It's now up to $88,000, and each time he gets paid, Kim is allowed to keep staying in this house rent-free.
Okay, outrageous, right? The owner of the property spoke to Fox News. This is clip B.
Injustice. Yes, justice is delayed. Justice delay means denied. 2 years of free taxpayers' money given to this guy and somebody. It's the same money. The taxpayer money is fighting against me.
All of the money has come from the Housing Justice Project, a nonprofit wing of the King County Bar Association. King County taxpayers have given the Housing Justice Project $16 million this year. The money, started during COVID, is designed to help hardship cases keep a roof over their heads, not pay very high rents in exclusive neighborhoods. And Kim has done this before, living in a house a mile away without paying rent for 2 years. The homeowner lost over $100,000.
$80,000 to a serial squatter is not what these programs are intended for. And what you're seeing is a perversion of the system and a de-emphasis in private property rights.
Reagan Dunn is calling for an audit of the Housing Justice Project, but it's an uphill climb for him because he is the only Republican on the King County Council.
Okay, that has to change. And this idea, basically, of the government taking the case of a squatter and backing that individual rather than the rightful homeowner who is due back rent, it's outrageous. And that idea that you're always okay if you take the underdog. Meanwhile, there's an underdog, but the question is, who is the real underdog and the real victim? That's the question in a fascinating new movie about a real-life episode from 100 years ago. It's a movie starring Oscar winner Olivia Colman. It's called Wicked Little Letters, and it's an unbelievable but true episode. Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Oscar winner Olivia Colman plays a pious spinster in a seaside community in 1920 Britain who is brutally harassed by a series of mysterious, anonymous, and tremendously obscene letters in Wicked Little Letters.
This time you owned up to these letters.
You allegedly harassed a pretty young Christian woman.
What's the evidence?
In the end, I think it's just jealousy.
Based on a bizarre true story that riveted attention shortly after World War I, Irish star Jesse Buckley plays the chief suspect for the poison pen assaults, with bizarre twists and turns leading to a dramatic trial. The performances are universally terrific, with Timothy Spall and Jenna Jones in colorful supporting roles. It's rated R because the characters read aloud some of the amazingly obscene language contained in the actual real correspondence of 100 years ago. 3 stars for the elegant and entertaining Wicked Little Letters. But if you're very sensitive to harsh language, you'll be sensitive to this film. Meanwhile, we are in the midst of our super special spring sale. 50% off.